Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. More than 130 people have died from Wuhan coronavirus in China so far. More than 6,000 people in China are ill. As the Chinese government and health officials worldwide scramble to curtail the spread of the virus, confirmed cases have popped up elsewhere, including the United States. While there's still a lot to be learned about this coronavirus, in a sense, we've been here before. Here's Thomas Crampton, then Asia correspondent for the International Herald Tribune, speaking to On Point from Hong Kong back in April of 2003.
In Hong Kong now, no sneeze is innocent. You walk down the street, everybody's wearing a mask, everybody's looking around trying to see if who's not wearing a mask, if they're going to cough or sneeze. This disease is believed to be spread by the droplets that come out with a sneeze or a cough.
Again, that was 17 years ago. Thomas was talking about SARS, another coronavirus. Now, SARS eventually reached 37 countries, and it killed over 700 people. Now that the world is facing a new coronavirus, what are the most important lessons to be learned from the SARS outbreak? Can those lessons be applied, and should they be applied, to containment efforts around Wuhan coronavirus? So this hour on Point, what it will take to stop coronavirus. And you can join us. We will be talking with several infectious disease specialists today. What do you want to know? What do you need to know about this new coronavirus? Well, we're going to begin in Bethesda, Maryland. Dr. Anthony Fauci joins us. He's director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the National Institutes of Health. Dr. Fauci, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So first of all, we do have at least five confirmed cases of Wuhan coronavirus in the United States. I was wondering if you might give us your evaluation of the current risk of the virus spreading in the U.S. at the moment.
Sure. Well, there are five individuals that are all travel cases directly from Wuhan, which is the epicenter in China of the outbreak. These individuals have been identified. They've been isolated. And what we're doing right now is we're doing what's called contact tracing on at least 100 individuals that came into contact with these individuals at the time that they were infected. Right now, there have been no indications, but we're still investigating it. The CDC is doing that there is a secondary transmission. In other words, there have been no human-to-human transmissions that have been recognized at this point in the United States, which is good news, because these people have been around for a while, and as each day goes by, we get more and more reports from the CDC about what the status of the contacts are. So right now, the risk is low, but as you know from what's going on in China, this is a very seriously evolving situation in China. But for the United States at this particular time, with the five individuals and no secondary transmissions, things seem to be at a low risk, but we've got to keep an eye on it because that can change.
And so tell us then, though, what you make of the current response so far, because I'm thinking if those five cases in the U.S. were travel cases, we still have hundreds, if not thousands, of flights coming in and out of the United States, perhaps fewer now from China, but from other places where we know coronavirus has been found.
Yeah, but it's a very good question, Meghna, and it's very important to distinguish. If you look at what's going on in China versus the relatively few cases in the countries in which there are travel-related, even though there has been some secondary transmission, such as in Germany, the burden of disease in those other countries that have travel-related cases is at this point so low that the odds of there being any importation from France or Germany or Japan of one of those countries is exceedingly low at this point. So the thing you need to concentrate on from a containment standpoint is taking the kind of surveillance of and testing of and attention to people who are coming in from China. Now, the important thing that the Chinese did that in many respects is very helpful is that they've essentially cut off flights out of Wuhan, which is overwhelmingly the epicenter. But the rest of China is starting to have the acceleration of cases. So that's the reason why, as you probably heard correctly, that we started off with five airports in there, which there was the kind of screening as people came in, a syndromic screening as well as a questioning screening. Now they've enhanced broad general screening of 15 additional airports now for a total of 20 for people who are coming from China. So right now, the real surveillance of what you want to do about people coming into the country is clearly focused on China and not focused on other countries in which there's one or two or three travel-related cases.
Right. So help me understand something, Dr. Fauci. We have seen a ballooning very quickly of the number of cases over the past several days, right? I mean, right. I think it was just yesterday in China, it was roughly 4,500. Then this morning, it jumped to around 6,000. That's a 25% increase overnight. Can you explain why that is? Is it the disease actually spreading fast, or are we finding more cases?
You know, it's a combination of both. I mean, what it is clearly it is spreading fast. What we're seeing now is that we're into what we call the generations of infection. So if I get infected, I'm first generation. If I infect you, that's second. If you infect somebody else, that's third. You know, we're well into six, seven, eight, and long. So when you have a number of people who are infected and they're infecting a few people, then you're going to have a major, I wouldn't say explosion, but certainly an acceleration of cases. There's a terminology called the R-aught, which means that how many infected people will get infected from one index case. Mm-hmm. So if I infect two people, then the R-aught for me is two. But R-aught is a population-based thing. So it's really an average of how many people get infected from people who are already infected. Right now, that's about 1.5 to 3.5, 3.6. When you look at really rapidly spreading diseases like measles, is up there in 11, 12, 13, 14, 18. It's really very high. But it's high enough now that it is accounting for this type of spread. The real question is the measures that the Chinese have done are really rather draconian in the sense of shutting down 45 million people.
Right.
Whether or not that's going to have a positive effect or might backfire and have some deleterious effects like causing panic or interfering with supplies in and out, we don't know. And the reason we don't know is because this has been unprecedented. There's been restrictions in other outbreaks, but never to this magnitude. So if this helps, we're going to be obviously looking very, very closely over the next weeks to months whether that acceleration that we're seeing is going to continue, which would be quite ominous, or whether it's going to slow down based on not only what the Chinese are doing within their own country, but the recognition of other countries of travel cases and having them handle it properly, the way we were fortunate enough to do in the United States, namely that those five cases were recognized early, they were isolated, and they have their contacts traced. If that happens broadly, we're in relatively better shape.
Right.
If you have spillover into other countries and lack of control, then we'd have a problem.
Okay. Oh, there's so many questions here, Dr. Fauci. Let me just ask you, do we yet know confidently where this coronavirus has come from?
You know, we don't know confidently what the precise jump was from an animal to a human, but I can say with some considerable confidence that knowing coronaviruses and what their animal reservoirs, it almost certainly started off with an animal-human interface because the reservoir of these infections, coronavirus, are an animal, particularly bats, are very important in the reservoir aspect of this infection. So, you know, if it acted like, well, let me give you some examples quickly. With SARS, we finally found out it was a bat that gave it to a palm civet cat, which then interacted with the human species. With mares, it was a bat that gave it to a camel, and camel gave it to people. So I would not be surprised, even though I don't know precisely, that it was something similar to what we've seen with SARS and with mares.
So this zoonotic transmission of disease, I mean, are we just going to see more and more of this as time goes by?
Well, you know, as long as we continue to do two things, encroach upon the environment where animals are that we usually don't have human-animal interface, the more you do that, encroaching on rainforests, encroaching on pristine areas of the environment, you'll see it. But also, it's the proximity between the human species and animal types that actually harbor viruses. And we know we see that in China a lot. And that's the reason why when you talk about flu a lot, even though it isn't exclusive, often you see flu coming out from China. And the reason is that flu is fundamentally a wildfowl bird type infection that has reservoirs in birds and in chickens and in pigs. And when you talk about the agricultural situation in a country like China, which traditionally has people very much intermingling with ducks and with birds and with chickens and with pigs, that's how you have the jumping of species. Mm. That's what we're seeing with the H5N1 that had gone on years ago and the H7N9 flu that is now still a little bit of an issue with some infections occurring.
Right. Well, Dr. Fauci, we've just got you for another 30 seconds or so. Do you think that examining the global response to SARS is a good way to draw lessons about the best way to contain this coronavirus?
In some respects, yes. I mean, obviously, good public health practices with SARS, namely identification, isolation, and contact tracing, successfully put an end to SARS. So that would have to at least be an important element of what we're doing here with the coronavirus.
Well, Dr. Anthony Fauci is director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the National Institutes of Health. Dr. Fauci, thank you so much for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
Well, when we come back, we'll talk with two more infectious disease specialists about how the global health community should best contain this outbreak of coronavirus. And we want to know what your questions are. What do you want to know about the spread of coronavirus? This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the spread of Wuhan coronavirus and whether there are important lessons to be learned from the SARS outbreak back in 2002 and 2003. Now, in a press conference just yesterday, Hong Kong's leader Carrie Lam outlined security measures she has taken to stop the spread of Wuhan coronavirus between mainland China and Hong Kong. Here she explains why.
One of the keys to controlling the epidemic is to substantially reduce the flow of people between the two places. In other words, we are not just talking about mainland visitors to Hong Kong, but also Hong Kong travellers to the mainland. And the number of commuters must be reduced substantially both ways.
That's Hong Kong's leader, Carrie Lam, translation provided by BBC News. Well, I'm joined today by Dr. Samira Mubaraka. She's an infectious disease physician and microbiologist at Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center with us from Toronto, Canada. Dr. Mubaraka, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And also with us from Baltimore, Maryland, is Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo. She's an epidemiologist and senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security and director of the Outbreak Observatory, which conducts research to improve outbreak preparedness and response. Dr. Nuzzo, welcome to you.
Thanks so much, Magna.
Now, Dr. Mubaraka, if I can just start with you. You have, in your hospital there at the Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center in Toronto, you've had or treated a confirmed case of coronavirus. Is that right?
That is correct.
So tell us a little bit about how that went and what tells us about the kind of response we should be having.
Sure. So the patient in question was actually quite well informed. So very fortunately, when he informed the EMS or the paramedics that he required transportation, he alerted them even before they got to his home of his travel history and his symptoms. So from the get-go, people were well aware and well prepared. So the individuals who picked him up were wearing the required personal protective equipment and fortunately also passed on the information to our institution. So when we welcomed him in our emergency department, he was put in isolation from the very beginning and has been in isolation ever since.
And his family members?
So his family members are self-isolated at home, so also were aware that they needed to self-isolate. So there really has been very little from the time at least that he arrived in Toronto exposure to the public. So we're very grateful and they seem to be quite acutely aware of what they needed to do. I have to admit, I don't know exactly where they were educated about that, if it was before they left or in transit or once they landed in Pearson, but certainly they took the appropriate steps to protect the people around them.
I see. So this is one of those travel cases, as Dr. Fauci was talking about.
Correct.
But in this case, in Canada. Okay. So Dr. Nuzzo, let's take a step back here. And I'm going to ask both of you this. From your perspective as an epidemiologist, what are some of the most important questions you'd like to have answered first of all, or right now, about this coronavirus?
Yeah, so the thing that I'm paying a lot of attention to is the severity of the reported cases and the not just the numbers of deaths, but the numbers of deaths in proportion to the number of reported cases. You know, as we enhance surveillance, both within China and outside of China, it's not terribly surprising that the case numbers are going up. In fact, to some extent, that's somewhat reassuring that we are finding additional cases. And also reassuring is that so far a number of the additional cases, particularly those reported outside of China, are have more mild illness. And so it really makes us have to question and thinking about what the risk posed from this virus is not just the numbers of cases, but how severe is it in relation to other respiratory viruses? And I think that's where there's still an open question. I think where we are this week is looking a little bit different than where we were last week. And I'm sure next week we might feel differently still.
Well, so just to follow up on that, you said the cases reported outside of China are more mild than those inside of China. Do we have any understanding about why that might be?
We don't. I mean, I think there are a number of possibilities. One, the first one is maybe just people who are healthy tend to be the ones who travel, and those may not be the people who are as likely to develop severe illness or die. It could also be that we're just, you know, finding these cases. It's just, you know, it could just be a coincidence. It could also be that, you know, there's just something about the cases in China that are different, the severe cases, and I don't think we really have a handle on that.
So, Dr. Mubaraka, what are some of the key questions that you want to be answered or need to know about coronavirus now?
Well, I think there are a couple of basic questions. I mean, we have some idea based on publications from a smaller cohort of what the clinical presentation is like right now. Not surprisingly, it's not unlike many of the other respiratory viruses that we see. The Lancet paper did highlight a few key features that are helpful to know in a minority of patients. For example, there was some cardiac injury. We have a sense now what we might expect to see on x-rays and CAT scans. So more information like that, just really basic information, is very helpful. It'll be very helpful as well to understand the distribution of the virus in the body. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a small proportion of individuals in that, again, very small series of acutely and quite severely unwell individuals. So you have to bear that in mind as well, that they had some virus in their blood, and obviously they had virus in their respiratory tract, but what's the distribution? How long do they shed for? With prolonged shedding, is it still infectious? We don't know that. We don't know about how much the environment might get contaminated, so be it the air or surfaces. Those were some of the things that I know that people looked at both for SARS and for MERS as well, because it has implications in terms of infection control also. So you're looking at the patient, but you're also looking at the environment around them. That would be helpful. And then just trying to understand, what are the risk factors for severe disease? Because we're seeing quite a spectrum of disease. And it's always helpful with any kind of syndrome to understand early on in a patient's course, who is at risk of getting worse? So that you can decide whether to admit them, or is it okay for them to go home? And there we will need a substantial amount of cases to really start to be able to pick out those determinants.
And you mean beyond sort of the regular risk factors of age, immunocompromise, things like that?
That is correct. I mean, we anticipate probably those will be important, but it's also important to know, because we need to plan. If this is going to be a significant epidemic or pandemic, if we understand what proportion need critical care, for example, we need to prepare for that eventuality.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Noza, we have a question here on our website. Josh wants to know, isn't this one, meaning the Wuhan coronavirus, contagious during asymptomatic incubation periods as well? So will the numbers, so infection numbers, I guess, aren't they going to jump like crazy?
So we don't really know the answer to that question. There have been some reports of that raise the prospect that people may be able to transmit infection potentially early in their disease, which, you know, I think has different implications than potentially SARS, where a lot of the transmission tended to be when people were kind of well progressed with their illness. But I think it's too early for us to truly know what the situation is. These are based on very small reports, and it's hard to tell. Sometimes people don't quite remember when their symptoms began to know sort of what level of asymptomatic transmission there is. Dr. Fauci at a press conference yesterday, I think, raised the fair point as to, you know, even if it's possible and it's been observed in outbreaks in the past to a limited degree, to what extent is this something that we really need to worry about in terms of overall case numbers? Do we expect large numbers of cases to be transmitted this way? And I think the evidence there is really mixed.
Yeah. Well, can you just remind us, because SARS is the example that keeps popping to mind, what ultimately led to the containment of SARS?
So in my mind, and I think many other people really credit, I think a lot of the heroics should be directed at health facilities. Mm-hmm. In particular, health facilities were important for the isolation and treatment of infectious cases, as well as the protection of healthcare workers who are involved in their care. And really, when we saw transmission to the community, many times it was involved healthcare facilities. And so really, I think the strongest evidence is that prompt case isolation and infection control in healthcare setting, while, you know, the heroic doctors and nurses who are treating the infected patients, to make sure they remain safe while doing so, I think was possibly one of the most important measures.
I see. Dr. Mubaraka, do you want to respond to that as well? What do you think were the factors that led to SARS containment?
I completely agree. I mean, for SARS, there were no antivirals, no vaccines, and it really was fundamental bread and butter infection prevention and control, as well as a very strong public health response, obviously. But Jennifer makes a good point. A lot of the transmission was in healthcare facilities, and that event really changed how many healthcare facilities now deal with even just run-of-the-mill seasonal influenza virus. Mm-hmm. And that was also reinforced further by the 2009 pandemic. So just to give you an example, a specific example, I can't work. I cannot renew my hospital privileges if I am not mask fit tested. You know, these types of administrative requirements, although they don't sound like a big intervention, it means that pretty much everyone, for example, at Sunnybrook now, who's working there, if they have hospital privileges, that they've been fit tested, and that's just one small part of it. Just the annual screening for febrile or respiratory illness for influenza is now de rigueur. Everybody, it's in place in most mm-hmm. Institutions, and now for something like this, you know, we're really just amplifying or increasing or enhancing what we're already doing. And just to briefly add, because both MERS and Ebola are currently active, people are already – so because it's the throes of flu season, I admit the timing is good and bad. I guess it's a double-edged sword. It's good in the sense that everybody is already thinking about febrile respiratory illness. And on top of that, because MERS and Ebola virus are active in certain jurisdictions, people are still being screened for travel. Because those systems are already in place, we can leverage them much more easily than trying to build them from scratch. So now, obviously, we add travel from Wuhan specifically, travel from China. It's so much easier than, you know, back in 2002 when none of that was in place. Yeah.
So a matter of luck there in the timing. But Dr. Nuzzo, since Dr. Mubaraka mentioned flu season here, just as for some perspective, and I know a lot of people probably want to know about this. I mean, since October of 2019 through January 18th of 2020, so a couple of month period in very recent history, the CDC estimates there have been 8,000 flu deaths in the United States alone, just in a couple of months. That's deaths from influenza. So are we overly concerned about coronavirus?
Yeah. So first of all, I think the level of concern right now is warranted given the uncertainties that we're dealing with. And we just don't simply know a lot about the virus to answer those key questions about severity and, mm-hmm. You know, the risk of progression to severe illness or death. So I think it's appropriate that we are giving this virus attention, trying to increase surveillance, to understand how widespread it may be, to understand how many mild cases there are out there versus the severe cases that would help us gauge the level of health threat posed by it. But I think it's absolutely critical that we do try to hold our knowledge about the virus in comparison to other respiratory viruses that we deal with on a day-to-day basis. And so that's why my earlier comments about paying attention very closely to the severity are key, because obviously any level of severe illness or death is a public health concern, but we also have to deal with a number of other viruses and need to compare what we're seeing with this virus to those in order to know, you know, how much of a relative threat it is.
Well, let's...
Where I live in Maryland, two children recently died from the flu. And, you know, and that's obviously a deeply worrisome situation.
Mm. Well, I just want to quickly go to a call before we got to take a break here. So let's go to Scott, who's calling from St. Petersburg, Florida. Scott, what's your question about coronavirus?
Hi, yes. I was wondering, it seems like there's a lot we don't know about it, and we're kind of learning as we go. But the crux of my question is, what are the course of treatments and how successful are they? Is it utterly fatal, or has there been successful recoveries?
Yeah, Scott, thank you for that question. Dr. Mubaraka, is there an antiviral for coronavirus?
Well, they're not directed specifically to coronavirus, but there are a number of antivirals that people are considering. The best way to really understand whether or not they benefit is through a randomized controlled trial. In the past, when we've kind of reacted to these emerging infections, we've kind of thrown in the kitchen sink, and some people do better, others don't. And in the end, it just becomes impossible to really analyze. So taking a very strategic and thoughtful approach is important. And so there are, from what I understand, at least one, maybe two clinical trials for antivirals. One that people might be more familiar with, or a combination people might be more familiar with, that's used for HIV treatment. And then another one that's a new antiviral that's not in FDA approved yet. So in a way, we can have a look at both of those, but it really will require a concerted effort to get enough patients on the same treatment or within the same trial to really come out with a recommendation at the end.
So how is it treated now then? I mean, hospitalization and observation?
So hospitalization, supportive treatment or supportive measures, obviously. If there's any possibility of a secondary infection, again, going back to that very small series of severe cases, there were a few people who developed bacterial infection afterwards. So providing antibiotics if they're necessary. And I know that in the past, people have used steroids to try and dampen the inflammation, but that's something that might actually have a negative effect in the sense that we don't know this for sure yet, but there is a chance that it actually will allow the viral shedding to prolong. So at this stage, steroids are not recommended. But really, we really need the data from these randomized trials.
Well, we are talking this hour about Wuhan coronavirus. We're talking with two infectious disease specialists, and we want to hear from you. What are your questions about this latest coronavirus? This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about Wuhan coronavirus, and we're talking with two infectious disease specialists to get a better understanding of exactly what this coronavirus is and the threat that it might pose and the best way for global public health officials to respond. I'm joined by Dr. Samira Mubaraka. She's an infectious disease physician and microbiologist at Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center in Toronto. And Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo joins us as well. She's an epidemiologist and senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security and director of the Outbreak Observatory, which conducts research to improve outbreak preparedness and response. Now, Dr. Nuzzo, I want to lean on that your job as director of the Outbreak Observatory here for a second. So let me just play a bit of tape from China. This was on Chinese state television on Monday, where Wuhan's mayor, Zhou Xiangwang, expressed disappointment with Wuhan's, as a city, the city's response to the coronavirus outbreak.
Facing a sudden virus outbreak, our continuous work wasn't performed well enough. I feel that our capability of dealing with a crisis needs to be improved.
So, Dr. Nuzzo, a little earlier in the hour, we talked about, Dr. Fauci described it as the draconian measures being taken in China to contain coronavirus. I'm just wondering what your initial thoughts on how the Chinese government has responded so far.
Yeah, so I think there are a number of actions for which they should be commended. I want to stress that one of the things we've learned in studying outbreak responses is that they're always hard and there are always missteps no matter where these outbreaks happen. And that's just something to be expected. And one of the reasons why we started the observatory was to try to learn from these things and share that knowledge so that we can be better ready the next time. I think in terms of responding once they appeared to know about the outbreak, that they should be commended, the speed with which the virus was identified and sequenced, and having that sequence shared internationally publicly is also a point for which they could be commended. I think some of the initial epi investigations that we heard about were also important, and I'm glad that information was shared about those efforts.
I thought I had heard that there was some concern that that exact information wasn't shared fast enough. Foreign researchers weren't allowed into China to do that work.
I've heard mixed stories on the degree to which collaborations are happening. I mean, certainly there have been some instances in which collaborations are happening. I think the fact that we are seeing now multiple countries standing up surveillance for a completely new virus and sharing that information, I mean, I think that speaks to the level of international involvement that there has been. That said, there are still, I think, holes in our knowledge for which we hope to get more information. I think we now have seen an epidemic curve from China just showing identified cases and their illness onset dates, which is really important because when we hear of new cases being reported, it's maybe tempting to say, oh, there's a huge jump in cases, but we actually don't know when those cases first became sick. And so it can be hard to tell the pace by which the infections are spreading. Mm-hmm. So I think there is more information that is still needed. But I want to stress that getting that information is not easy. It's incredibly laborious work.
Right. So can I just ask you about that? Because it's de facto laborious work to get that information.
Yeah.
And and frankly speaking, is it even harder when the epicenter of where that information is in a nation like China, where, because to be frank, like authoritarian rule, I mean, we've seen that they've put more than 40 million people essentially on some form of lockdown. Do those actions and the political environment in China, does it make that work that much harder?
So let me just put on hold for a second, just those kind of heavy-handed, the lockdowns, et cetera, because I want to treat those separately.
Okay.
But just talk about the kind of day-to-day work that needs to be done to get the answers to some of these questions. So, it's not just a case of diagnosing, not just a need to diagnose a case and to figure out when they first develop symptoms. It's also they're obviously asking about potential exposures. You know, initially there were a lot of concerns that these cases may have been linked to a particular market. And so asking people about their potential exposure to the market or their relationship to people who may have had a connection to the market. These are very detailed, time-intensive actions. Mm. And then even in the best of circumstances, absent any kind of concerns about being forthcoming with your disease, people don't remember properly. They may forget. They may feel that they shouldn't say, particularly once, news of this virus were coming. People may not want to have identified that they were connected to the market in some way. So it's just very, very difficult work. And I just want to stress that because I think it's easy to criticize from the outside when you're not, living it day to day. That said, and I'm going to come back now to the lockdowns, I am deeply worried about those approaches because while they may be theoretically possible to slow the spread of illness by limiting people's movements and their ability to come in contact with other people, we have to evaluate that theoretical benefits. And I stress theoretical because there's not a whole lot of evidence about those benefits being actualized when they try to actually do these measures. Mm. You have to balance those theoretical benefits with what the secondary and tertiary effects of those approaches could be. So one of the things I'm worried about, we heard that there was essentially a lockdown on the city of Wuhan. The mayor of Wuhan has said that he estimated that possibly about 5 million people left the city prior to the implementation of those measures. So just right off the bat, we would be worried about that cases could just be dispersed over a greater geographic area. And that's not great because then we have, it's going to be harder to conduct surveillance. It's going to be harder to find those cases and potentially to interrupt transmission. Right now, most countries are screening travelers. And one of the questions is, have you been to Wuhan? If we now have to expand that, as we probably will have to do to China, that increases the number of people that will answer yes to that question.
Right.
And then if we think about expanding beyond China, I mean, it just grows. And the other thing I really worry about is when countries take these very heavy-handed measures, are they going to be causing more harm to the people who are subjected to them?
Right. Well, Dr. Mubarak, I appreciate your patience here over the past several minutes. I'm just wondering what your view is to that same question about how the response has been unfolding in China.
Well, certainly compared to what we saw during SARS, it's a significant improvement. I mean, with SARS, there was really very little information for months. Mm-hmm. Whereas in this case, and it must have been a very difficult decision to make because they called it based on, from what I understand, 40 cases of severe pneumonia of unknown etiology. And in a city of 11 million people, to call something like this based on that small number must have been a very difficult decision to make because the implications of coming out with an announcement like that are fairly significant. And it's a good thing that they did. So that happened fairly early. And in addition to that, we are seeing quite a bit of sharing of the actual investigation and the sequences of the virus, et cetera. These things have all come out within 2 weeks, really.
Uh-huh.
From the onset, which is vastly different compared to what happened with SARS. So certainly from that perspective, and that's made all the difference in terms of other jurisdictions and scientists being able to get working on diagnostic assays, vaccines, all of those other important interventions that rely on that type of information. So at least at that beginning phase, there seems to have been a big difference relative to what we saw 17 years ago.
Interesting. Well, let's go back to our callers. Let's go to Mike, who's calling from New Orleans. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi. Don't you think that with all we know, and most of all what we don't know about the novel coronavirus out of Wuhan, that we should go ahead and urge our leaders, namely the president's cabinet lead on this, Alex Azar, and Dr. Redfield from the CDC, to quarantine anybody coming from mainland China for 14 to 21 days landing here in the United States? We shouldn't gamble with United States citizens' lives on what we don't know. We should learn from what the Hong Kong president said. And don't you think that we should do that? This incubation period is 2 to 14 days. What we know is that it can be transmitted from person to person, that people who have it during this incubation period can pass it on without showing any signs of having the virus.
Right. So you're suggesting that anyone coming from China into the United States ought to be quarantined for about up to 3 weeks upon their arrival, Mike? Is that what you're suggesting?
Correct. We should be, after they come out of quarantine, we should know 100% that they do not have the novel coronavirus.
Okay. So, Mike, let me turn that to Dr. Nuzzo here. First of all, well, would that work, Dr. Nuzzo?
So I think the first question is, could we even do it if we wanted
right.
to? And I think
right.
the answer to that is clearly no. I mean, there are thousands of people coming. And as the geographic footprint of this epidemic increases, you know, their situation report yesterday said 14 countries were reporting cases. You know, it may be increasingly futile to even focus, you know, on just even a handful of countries. So I think what the approach has been is to you know, educate travelers, of course, about the symptoms, particularly directing that education at travelers from China, and to, you know, give them an opportunity and information about where, you know, who they should contact should they develop those symptoms. And when we do identify somebody as potentially, you know, a potential coronavirus case, obviously they need to undergo testing. And then when we find the case, isolate them so that they can't transmit their infection. I mean, I think it's really important. The first two cases that appeared in the United States were in individuals who didn't develop their illness until they were already home and, you know, they had gone through the airports. And, you know, they seemed similar to the experience so far in Canada, it sounds like, to be educated enough to to recognize that maybe they could have been infected and to contact health care providers so that they could be evaluated. And, you know, I think that's a really encouraging sign, and we should continue to make sure travelers are educated so that they can do that.
Well, so I want to spend the last couple of minutes talking about the importance of public education when it comes to disease outbreaks like this. So let me just play a moment from the press conference yesterday in Washington, where Alex Azar, the Secretary for Health and Human Services, talked about coronavirus, and he called it a constantly changing situation.
The CDC has reported 5 cases of the novel coronavirus infection here in the United States. China has now reported more than 4,500 cases. Americans should know that this is a potentially very serious public health threat. But at this point, Americans should not worry for their own safety.
And just to show how much the situation is changing, when Secretary Azar spoke about this yesterday, there were those 4,500 cases in China. As of this morning, it was over 6,000 in China. But Dr. Mubaraka, let me just ask you, there is, as we've been talking about, an important part of the puzzle of containment is public education here. The media can also perhaps unnecessarily inflame concern, right? How do you think those two things are playing together now in terms of the coverage of coronavirus?
Well, I think you have to hit the right tone. You're correct. It's difficult to do that because you want to inform people of the risk. But for many people, just being aware of a risk makes them quite anxious about it. And I think what reassures people is when we could say, look, it's not that we're not prepared. It's not that we're not anticipating this or we're downplaying the possibility, but it's more to tell people that our best chance at actually mitigating spread is for individuals to identify themselves if they do meet certain criteria. And most places will have specific criteria by which they want to screen individuals. And that might vary a little bit from one center to the other, but for the most part, I think they're fairly unified. And I think that pairing that with the message that, okay, if there are cases, if there are people who need to be tested, we have the means to do it. We have the means to do it safely. We have somewhere for these individuals to go where they could be looked after that still provides the care that these people need without endangering the health of the people who are looking after them and the health of the public. I think it has to be a clear message that doesn't downplay the risk, but also highlights what is already in place to really mitigate further spread.
Well, people always want to know, and Dr. Nuzzo, I'll turn to you on this. People always want to know on an individual level, what can they do to prevent the transmission or prevent catching something like coronavirus? Do masks work? Hand washing?
Well, hand washing is always a good idea. In terms of masks, there's no need for people who are not involved in caring for patients to be using masks. And in fact, if people go out and try to find masks, we've already heard reports of sales increasing and shortages of masks. I mean, that could essentially cause more harm because we want to make sure that we reserve those important supplies for people in the healthcare field so that they can use them and care for patients in a safe manner. And if there are interruptions in the supply of masks, I believe that would put most of us at greater harm than if we were to, than just simply trying to use masks and going about our day-to-day lives would.
Well, Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo is an epidemiologist and senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security and director of the Outbreak Observatory, which conducts research to improve outbreak preparedness and response. Dr. Nuzzo, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Magna.
And Dr. Samira Mubaraka, infectious disease physician and microbiologist at Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center in Toronto. Dr. Mubaraka, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Thank you.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.